Welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, hosted by Dr. Ryan Mauley and Travis Buzzell. Join us on this journey as we educate the patient population, inform today's medical providers, and inspire tomorrow's medical leaders through education and in-depth discussion. We can all discover today's best healthcare solutions. Now, sit back and enjoy Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters.
Hey everybody, Dr. Ryan Sawbones Mauley here, along with my partner,
Travis Buzzell.
And welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters. So, Trav, you know, I've been wanting to have this guest on for several months now. Yeah. I'm so excited that the day is finally here where we get to talk with him. We've had an opportunity to speak with him for maybe 15, 20 minutes before we started recording here. But yeah. Every episode that we do, it's when I finish, I'm almost like, this is one of my favorite episodes. And I have a feeling that this is going to be either one of my favorite episodes or one of maybe the most deepest, more personable episodes, or maybe both.
Definitely. Yeah. So without further ado, Dr. Rosen.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. And yeah, thanks for those kind words.
Yeah.
So a little bit about me. I was born and raised in Philadelphia and trained there, and moved from East Coast to West Coast to do my fellowship in total joint replacement, and have been on staff here at San Diego for the past 20 years as a subspecialist doing predominantly hip and knee replacement. In addition to all the patient care stuff, I've been really interested in the social media aspect, both for those of us in the medical field. So created a podcast there, and then more importantly for patient education. So that was sort of my COVID project, was writing a book all about knee arthritis and knee replacement for patients, and created both a podcast and a YouTube channel that helps share reliable online information for patients where they can access it and find things that are not misinformation, but clean and concise and to the point.
This guy is literally a brother from another mother, right? Yeah. Like my entire practice for 15 years has been focused on patient education. And I haven't written a book about it yet, but I've done over 300 free patient educational seminars, recorded 60 or more patient focused, educational videos that my patients have access to, surgical videos that they have access to, our website, the whole process, right, from when they come in to after surgery is education driven and very, very heavy, but and very similar passions.
And that's something that I, you know, Dr. Rosen and obviously Dr. Mauley, that you guys have seen, but, you know, I have a lot of these interactions with, you know, my role in this whole thing with patients. And I can tell you that it's very much appreciated, because I know it takes a lot of time to put together that sort of content. And like you said, like concise, you know, accurate. I mean, because, you know, you can Google just about anything and find a bunch of stuff, and it's like, is this right? Is this accurate? But like that sort of education, I can tell you, you know, yeah, there's always a population of, you know, those patients that are like, you know, oh, snooze fest, you know, I don't just do my surgery and talk to me after sort of thing, you know. And but I can tell you that the vast majority of the people that I interact with, just like from a clinical standpoint, from the stuff that we do, it really goes a long way. And I do think it improves the outcome.
Oh, well, for sure. Satisfaction for sure, too.
Yeah. I just feel like they're in the know, and, you know, they're getting answers to questions that they didn't know they had. And I hear that all the time, which I think is huge.
Yeah. So
I think patients nowadays, you know, they're looking for that. I think in the old days, right, you get the, you know, the old male surgeon, you know, who's just brief to the point and, you know, see my girl up front, she schedules you for surgery. Like, informed consent was zero.
You need a knee, sign here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was kind of the way it was done for so long. But yeah, I mean, patient education is so important. And I'm sure, Ryan, like you've seen it too, like, you know, these second opinions I get were technically, like in the knee world, everything's done well. Like, it's well lined, it's well balanced, but they're stiff and they didn't do the rehab. They didn't know what was expected, you know. And once you have the spiel with them, you know, they all say, I wish my doctor would have told me that. Like, if I knew, like, I would have pushed through the pain or worked harder or done something different. You know, at that point, it's too late. So I like being able to, you know, share that information with these patients. And this way they come in much more educated, but, you know, knowing what to expect.
100%. So, you know, I'm always fascinated the origin story, right? So, like, who was it that inspired you to go into medicine? Is it a family member? Were you an athlete? Because almost all orthopedic surgeons either had a family member, they were an athlete, or something along, had an injury and had some type of ACL reconstruction, and then they got interested.
Yeah, no. So it's a great question. I luckily didn't have any like major orthopedic injuries that required surgery, but broke a fair number of bones. And you know, the town that I grew up in, there was the local orthopedic surgeon that you know, we all knew. And my impression as a young kid was that orthopedic surgeons wear pajamas to work and play with plaster of Paris. That's what I thought they did. And I just thought that would be the greatest job in the world. You know, in the manuscript that I'm writing now about, you know, what happened to me this past year and a half, like, I go into a lot of detail of like how I got to where I was, because I knew I was interested in medicine. So then in high school, I became an EMT and, you know, worked on the local ambulance squad. And then when I was in college, I volunteered at a hospital and there were no residents. So it was not a teaching hospital. So I was sort of this like unique person that really wanted to learn stuff. So the nurses took me under their wing. They knew I wanted to do ortho. So anytime, you know, the ortho guys got called in to reduce a wrist or something, I was there to help out. But I remember the first time they had a hip fracture and they were like, yeah, go up to the OR. We're good here. There's kind of, you know, nothing going on. And I walked into this operating room, like after spending years of like building climbing walls and stuff like that, and saw these tables laid out with drills and saws and all these instruments that were sterile and all lined up. And I was just like, man, this is the coolest thing in the world. And they did a DHS. It was like the first DHS I saw. And I was just like, yeah, I'm hooked. Like, I'm in 100%.
Most residents these days wouldn't even know what a DHS is, right?
Right, isn't that crazy?
They're putting nails in where, you know, some of these simpler fracture patterns, like where you trained, I'm sure you did them. Where I trained, we did them. I would say 50% of the time we did DHSs over IMHSs, which is just for the lay people out there. A DHS stands for a dynamic hip screw. There's a plate, usually a 2 or 4 hole plate with screws that go through that. And then there's a large screw that goes up in the femoral head and neck. Whereas a newer thing is intramedullary hip screw goes down inside the femoral canal. It's a nail. And then there's a second larger screw that goes through the nail, and usually a derotational or locking screw that goes through the bottom part of the nail too. So
it's so funny. Yeah. Doc, hearing you say like that story, Teddy Atlas, if you guys know who Teddy Atlas is,
yeah,
famous boxing coach. And he gives this speech. He's like, you know, we're firemen. We'd run into the fire. I feel like every single orthopedic surgeon that we've talked to have like seen these like surgeries and these procedures that most people would just be like, oh my God, I might actually pass out. What's going on? Where you guys are just like, I need more. I like, yeah. I'm hooked to this. Like, I feel like it really is a calling. Most people are not like in tuned with anything like that. I mean, for the first time, right? I mean, I guess, you know, it grows on you a little bit, but everyone that we've talked to, it's like, it's almost love at first sight, kind of.
A little light bulb goes off.
Yeah.
For most of them.
Yeah. I know that's
it's definitely not for everyone. I mean, and you see that look like on, you know, medical students that rotate through ortho that don't want anything to do with surgery or ortho. I mean, you see that complete opposite look on their face. Like, this is barbaric. I want out.
Yeah. Barbaric is kind of a good word.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's barbaric. It's like, I want in.
You know, like so many patients, like, you know, oh, do you do MIS? And I'm like, look, like if we crack your chest and then now we make little keyholes, like that's MIS. But like how big the incision is, I'm still taking a hammer and a saw to your body. Like there's nothing minimally invasive about that.
Yeah. Unless the I stands for like incision, minimal incision, which to me, my mentors, Lombardi and his mentor, Dr. Mallory, used to say, hey, skin heals side to side. It doesn't heal lengthwise. It's not like it's going to start at the top of the incision, work down, and the longer the incision, the longer it takes to heal. So right. I'm not one of those guys that gets cute with small incisions.
Yeah, the tiny, tiny. And that's, you know, because I was part of that phase too. Like that was the, maybe like the 2005 to 2010 world where, you know, we went from like really big down to super small. And, you know, not only were implants put in well, you didn't get cement out, but those wounds were stretched traumatically that the scars looked worse. So I'm like you, you know, it's like any question, just lengthen the scar. Like here in San Diego, patients will ask for like hips, like how big's the scar? So I always tell them like, it's bigger than a bikini, but smaller than board shorts.
Mine is you wear a size 5 dress, you get a size 5 incision. You wear a size 15 dress, you get a size 15 incision.
Yeah. And that works too, you know, right? Patient expectations, you got to set them up front.
So a part of the origin story, something that's coming up for me that kind of I have some curiosity. So Philly, East Coast guy, transitioning to Southern California. Like, what's that like? I mean, obviously you're indoctrinated now, but.
Yeah, super different. You know, it's funny because, you know, I spent a lot of time in the woods growing up, climbing and things like that. So I had always had the impression like I'd wind up in Colorado or something like that. So I figured I was going to be west of the Mississippi. But my mentor in Philly, like we were talking about what I wanted to do for fellowships. And, you know, he was just like, yeah, there's like one place you got to go. And, you know, came out here. I will say, you know, over 20 years, things have changed. But when I came out here, people were amazed at how fast I talked and how direct I was. So you got a lot of like California patients that were really like put off by, oh my God, he's so direct. And I've definitely accumulated a lot of the East Coast transplants. So many patients over the years are the ones from, you know, New York. They walk in the door and I'm like, hey, what borough are you from? And they're like, how do you know I'm from the East Coast? I'm like, come on, like you're from the Bronx or Brooklyn or Queens. Like you can hear it. And even like the Philly people, you know, I've picked up a lot of them, you know, and they're unique. So like you'd get a kick out of this. Like one of my partners had taken care of this couple from Philly for years. And the guy was out of town. So I was seeing his patient because he had an issue. And we're talking and he's like, you're from Philly? I'm like, yeah, I'm from Philly. Hold on. He pulls out his phone and he calls his wife. His wife's in the waiting room. She comes back. He's like, you're not going to believe it. She's like, what? He's like, guess where he's from? She's like, where? He's like, Philly. He's like, get the fuck out of here. I'm like, that's Philly to a T.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Love it. Yeah, there's no, we're not going to put a bleep on that one.
No, that's hilarious.
But I mean, that's, you know, that Philly's a unique breed. I mean, we love our Eagles. We love our Flyers. You know, I like the pretzels and the cheesesteaks. And
yeah, are you Pats or Geno's or what are you doing there?
I was a Pats guy growing up. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I've eaten at all of them, but, you know, it's, you start to get, you know, pulled in one direction. And yeah, the Oliveri family, I mean, they like the cheesesteaks. Even my sister, like for her wedding, you know, the sort of the after party. They actually brought in like 100 cheesesteaks from Pat's. And you know, after a night of dancing and drinking, like nothing hits better than a bunch of cheesesteaks.
Yeah, heck yeah, man. Get that grease in the belly, right? That's doctor's orders right there.
Exactly.
So do you get home much?
No, I don't get home that often. Yeah, I definitely don't miss the East Coast. My brother still lives in Philly. You know, my sister lives in Jersey. Mom lives in Florida. I mean, she went to like where everybody in the Northeast goes when they retire, right? You go to Florida.
Is she in the Villages or where?
She's in West Palm.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's, I don't head out there that often. And then, you know, especially with COVID, you know, you missed all those years of traveling. So
yeah,
we kind of probably should get back more, but I was telling you can come out here. It's a lot nicer out here.
Yeah. I'm sure they take you up on that too, or they should.
They should. But yeah, they haven't taken it up that often.
And you mentioned the Eagles and are you still a pretty avid Phillies or Philadelphia fan, whether it's, you know, football, baseball, basketball?
Yeah. Cause San Diego is not a sports town. Like even when the Chargers were here, like it was amazing. Cause you know, if you're in Philly and the Eagles lost, like everybody was in a depression for a full week. Bash the coach, bash the manager. Like they should have put Zoloft in the water for the week. And, you know, here the Chargers get blown out and people are like, I'm going to the beach.
Well, it is 78 and sunny every day with no cloud in the sky. So there's that.
Yeah, weird. So no, but you know, being from Philly, like I still love the Eagles and I still hate Dallas. So, you know, just kind of watch the games and yeah.
So you were at PCOM. I mentioned my buddy when he was there. You guys, I think, trained or like the 76ers, the practice facility was like a PCOM facility, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, cause, for years, Dr. McPhill and me was the chair of the program and he took care of the Sixers, you know, for years. So you could always see him, you know, behind the bench for home games. So I think, I don't know the exact details of how they got there, but I'm sure something had to do with it. With his office was right across the street, so bringing the practice facility there. But he was the Sixers doc for as long as I can remember when I was there in Philly.
Yeah. My buddy said he would be in there in the weight room and AI would come in and he wasn't too much into practice, right? But Eric Snow, I don't know if you remember Eric Snow. He was a tough Michigan Stater, actually. And my buddy Greg Eric would be like, hey, can you spot me, man? He'd come over and he'd be benching and he'd be like, dude, I just spotted for Eric Snow today. I'm like, dude, that's awesome.
That's pretty cool. And I had mentioned kind of when we were talking before, when I first started my career in med device, I worked for a company in Irvine. So I'd get to Southern California, I mean, probably 3-4 times a year. And, you know, we'd either go the weekend before or the weekend after, and we'd always, you know, go down to San Diego for, you know, a weekend or something like that. So I've been to Petco Park a couple times. Petco Park's pretty cool. And especially
is that where the Padres play?
Yeah. As of late, you know, they have that little watch area, which is really cool. It's literally like a mini baseball field with a massive sort of screen. And I mean, it's pretty cool. And obviously they're much better now than they were when, you know, I was back there in, you know, 2011 right. or something like that. But, you know, but yeah, you're right. It's weird for, you know, all the big sports franchises that they do have there. It's just sort of like come and go. They're good. They're right. good. They're not good. They're not good. Yeah. No one really cares.
So yeah,
Petco's great. That's a beautiful, you know, beautiful place and venue. And it's nice too, because they've really sucked in all the locals. So like all the local restaurants are in there. Like all the local breweries are in there. So even if someone's visiting, you know, they really get to experience like all of the San Diego sort of eateries and breweries in one place.
Yeah. It's because it's kind of a unique, like the part of town it's in. A buddy of mine, he was down there for a while and it was like, wasn't like getting to the park wasn't like a treat. Like it wasn't like in a great part of town, but then you have like this amazing sort of venue, right? And like, I think that sort of, that move bringing all of those restaurants and some of the other bringing that in sort of, I don't want to say like barricaded them a little bit, but it created a little bit of a barrier there, which I think was helpful to draw people to come to the area, to come to games and, you know, eat and do all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, cause when I was, I mean, it was fine. I mean, I didn't mind walking, but I mean, he kind of told me some stories. I was like, oh, I don't know. We were walking around here alone. Yeah.
But it's close to, it depends on which direction too. Like, you know, cause from the south, it can be a little shady, but you know, the other part comes from the Gas Lamp, which is sort of like the downtown Mecca of San Diego. So if you come through that area, the traffic's crazy, but that's where like all the big bars and restaurants are, right through the Gas Lamp district.
Yeah. I was there a couple of years ago it was a meeting. Maybe it was the Academy. I can't remember. I think it was the Academy and, was going to go to a Padres game, but we ended up, I can't remember why we didn't go. Ended up just going for a run down on the pier area there and hit up some great restaurants afterwards. But
I wanted to try to do, cause Miramar is, and they have like a, it's like a flight simulation or something that they have. I don't think maybe back in the day they would maybe take you up in a, you know, an old gen fighter jet or something like that. I don't know with liability if, you know, they would do that now, but they have like a simulator thing where, you know, people can go, I mean, in just under like a few G's, you know, it's like, you know, I've had some buddies that have done it and I'm like, yeah, I'm out. Like they haven't even gotten to the point where it's like, it's crazy. And these guys, they're passing out, throwing up. And I'm like, yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, I'd have to look into that. Yeah. Cause I mean, it's literally like, right over there. So all day, you know, like, you know, we hear the helicopters and the jets going over, especially when they have the air show. I mean, it's like all weekend long. You got
Yeah, you should look into it.
It's, you know, stealth bombers. It's just nonstop.
Yeah, I've heard it's pretty cool.
So my nephew's out there. He's been out there for a year now. Luke, he's in the Marines. And what's the big base out there?
Pendleton, then.
Yeah, he's at Pendleton. He's like military police out there. They had a one of the cadets or somebody went MIA and was missing for probably like 3 or 4 days. And my nephew was the one that actually found him and arrested him and put him in cuffs. He was like, dude, it was...
Where was he?
Who was the person that got caught?
No, where were they hiding?
Oh, he was on the base the entire time. But he was in like this abandoned area and he locked himself in. And
the most epic game of hide and seek ever.
He hid right on base. Wow. So
it's crazy.
So Adam, we were talking a little bit before we got officially recording here. You were kind of talking about your practice and you're in a really big group. I mean, 40 orthopedic surgeons, but all the different other subspecialties other than pediatrics. Do you mind just kind of talking about that a little bit? And because one of the things that we talk about a lot on Red Carpet are, you know, not only just identifying the problems in healthcare, but how do we produce solutions? And you're in a little bit of a unique situation because you're not hospital employed, but you're not private practice either.
Right. And it's like technically private. And even like, because when fellows come and interview, that's like the classic question, right? Like, you know, is it private, academic? It's that new sort of term, the privademic, you know, because we put out a ton of research and it's sort of part of the mission statement. And it's a requirement for our fellows. But it's technically sort of a private practice, physician-owned group. So, and it's got a big history. Like, it actually began as this small little clinic in La Jolla, like down in this like main La Jolla. And as the population grew, they moved up to where we are now. So, like, most people realize it's the hospital, like, right behind Torrey Pines. So, like, when you watch the Torrey Pines golf tournaments and you see Scripps Clinic in a building, like, that's our clinic, and the hospital next to it is Green Hospital. So when I joined in 2005, there was about 300 doctors. So multi-specialty across the board, except for pediatrics, because we have a big pediatric hospital down the road. And since then, they have absorbed smaller medical groups in the San Diego area and have reached out with more satellites. And also hired more people in each particular department and division. So now we're over 1,200 doctors. So I don't know if it's the or close to the largest medical group in San Diego, but we have sort of the main campus and kind of everywhere else with lots of satellites. So our orthopedic department, the idea when it was created, so it was 1978 when they came up there, and Dr. Caldwell was the head of orthopedics, and he created these subdivisions. So, you know, now we have all the subdivisions of orthopedics, and everybody sort of stays in their lane, and, you know, we refer out to the partners. And I mean, the nice thing is, I'll tell you, like, we have the greatest group of orthopedic partners. You know, unlike a lot of practices, especially big practices, you know, where you hear about people coming and going, like, nobody has left. There were like two older guys that retired out, one person before me that moved for family reasons, but everybody else that has joined the group has stayed. And it's so collegial where, you know, if I call a hand guy because, you know, I got a bad wrist fracture, like, yep, sure, you know, sports guy's on call, you know, calls me, hey, you got a hip fracture, yeah, sure. And even within our division of total joints, you know, like, hey, if you did someone's knee and they came and saw me for their other knee or their hip, and I wound up operating, like, nobody goes down the hallway and screaming and yelling, like, you stole my patient. So it's a pretty unique group that I don't think you see at a lot of places. So everyone's, you know, happy because we can rely on one another.
I guess what's the key to that, right? Because let's be honest, orthopedic surgeons are some of the most competitive, you know, breeds of humans, let alone, you know, physicians out there. And whatever you've got, is it the vitamin D, the beautiful San Diego weather, or what is it?
Yeah. I mean, I wish I knew. You know, I think a lot of it goes back to like our leadership. you know, because, you know, we all have the complaints of, you know, the hospital and the C-suite and things like that. But, you know, within our department, it's pretty tight knit. And I think, like, our leadership has done a really good job of just finding people that fit the personality. And even new hires go through sort of a sequence of really interviewing with almost everybody if it's possible. It's not as possible anymore now that we've gotten so much larger. But when we were smaller, like if you were looking for a job, you literally sat down with every single surgeon. And if someone got a bad vibe, or like, you know, I just don't think this person's a good fit, you know, they didn't get a spot. So everyone that's been chosen just has, you know, basically fellowship trains, they come with good training, and they have to fit that sort of mold without sort of those red flags that I think, you know, you see in our profession from time to time.
Yeah, you're definitely a sweet spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I, you know, when we were talking earlier, you know, I had a question because we talked to a spine surgeon in Minnesota, Dr. Sinacropi, and, you know, he has a sort of, obviously not on as large of a scale, but sort of that PSA model, you know, so, you know, for, you know, maybe some of the, you know, physicians, you know, watching, but like that professional service agreement. So they do something very similar where, you know, they're independent, they control all their own affairs, and they have, you know, this agreement with, you know, the hospitals and, you know, the various places, whether they're taking call or taking cases and all that sort of stuff. Like, do you guys have like a group of people, like non-physicians, that negotiate that, or are all of the providers, I mean, in terms of, I know it, you made it sound like the agreements are, you know, quite long, but when you're, you know, looking at that and reviewing like the fee for service, you know, making sure it's equitable, you know, the length of some of the contracts that you were talking about, obviously, as the ever changing landscape of healthcare, how does that work? Like, how involved are you guys with that? Or is there a team that does it?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And the disclaimer is I probably should know more about that whole process than I do. And that's kind of like, you know, one of the benefits, you know, I think about being in private practice yourself, like you have to have an understanding of all of that business sense. And where we are, like I can come in and see patients and bill for it and kind of forget about that other stuff. But luckily, when I started, our president of the medical group was one of the pulmonologists. And when he retired, the new president was one of my partners and actually one of my mentors when I was a fellow. So it was really nice, right, having an orthopedic surgeon as the president of the medical group. So he had not just doctors, you know, kind of understanding in mind, but also the surgeon's mentality. And then we have an office, you know, of non-physician people that are, you know, kind of employees of the medical group that really help do all of that stuff also. So they have a 25-year PSA that they're renegotiating right now. And then every 2 years, there's sort of an update to that. And that works out, you know, our fee-for-service RVU rates.
That was going to be my question. Are you all RVU-based for your productivity?
All RVU-based. Okay. Except for, like, the hospitalists, you know, which are salary-based.
Sure.
But I think the, you know, the whole milieu of healthcare has changed. So I don't know how far they've gotten, but the discussions that have come up, like, in our department, too, are the idea that, hey, in this agreement, like, there has to be verbiage for how many MAs a provider gets based on how many patients they see, and, you know, the hardware, because they bought the software, and, you know, making sure that we have the appropriate hardware and IT to do our job, because we had a big cyber attack, so all of us basically couldn't see patients and everybody lost revenue. It's like, okay, well, who's responsible for that lost revenue? It wasn't the doctors not showing up. It was the system was broken. So all of those sort of things, you know, need to go into place, even like in the operating room, because we don't own and hire like the x-ray techs, the surgical techs, the, you know, anesthesia is its own group, the medical assistants, the scheduler, all of those people are employees of the health system. So that's, I think, the goal now with the PSA is really being specific of what is required for each physician in each particular department to do their job in the most efficient way. And that where they're going to go with that and what they get, I don't know. I'm not privy to that probably until it's all over.
So, you know, one of the other major obstacles, issues, problems in healthcare is the physician burnout rate. I was, before we, you know, officially started recording here, we had some background talks about this, and I was mentioning to you guys how I don't think there's been one episode of Red Carpet or my other podcast, Hey Sawbones, where I haven't touched on this because it is massive. And I don't think that a lot of, I think a lot of patients are completely naive to it. I don't think that there's as many physicians that are unaware of this now, but you had a post on LinkedIn that I saw, and it was a YouTube video that you recorded at a late summer, midsummer, something like that.
Yeah. A few months ago now. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I must've caught it within the first couple minutes that you posted it. And I remember I was in my clinic seeing patients, and it was early enough that no patients were ready for me to actually see them yet. And I actually delayed seeing them because I got so caught up in your story of this that I couldn't stop watching it. It wasn't like, oh, I'll pick this up later. I was like, this is important. I need to watch this right now. So if you don't mind, can you just share with our guests, our audience, Travis and myself, your story, your experience with burnout and all the other stuff that goes along with that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, the hard part is right, like how to shorten it all up. And before I start going into it, something that you said, you know, about patients being unaware. And I like to believe, like, I have a really good relationship with a lot of my patients. So there were a lot of patients when I was out of work because of this reason that kept calling the clinic, like, hey, when's he coming back? I want to wait for him. I don't want to see a partner. And when I came back, they all were kind of concerned about, like, hey, what was going on? And a lot of them have seen that video now. And it was amazing to me about how nice they were and how caring they were and, like, how much as a patient, which, you know, we're supposed to take care of, but how open they were to try to care for me and, like, hey, is there anything that I can do? Like, you know, I'm sorry that you went through that. So that was really, really important to me, because one thing I wasn't sure is how healthcare professionals would take it, but also I was wondering, like, how patients would take it, and if it was out there, you know, would they abandon me, you know, thinking, oh, you know, I don't want to see him because he's got these issues going on. So yeah, for me, like I've always said, you know, like in the beginning, I loved my job. I loved operating. You know, if I was there late doing cases, it was great. You know, I loved the patients, I loved the workload, and, you know, like all of us, I just probably worked a lot more than I should have. And then, you know, around COVID, like all of us, and just prior to COVID, and I started getting overwhelmed with the patient demands. You know, everybody wants to be added on. You got to add another surgery here or there. You know, you were losing sleep. And I think any surgeon that doesn't wake up at 2 a.m. worrying about their patient probably isn't a good surgeon. You know, and those things sort of tax you day after day, week after week. But then we ran into all the issues, you know, EMR. Electronic medical record has been shown to be one of the leading causes of physician burnout. So we're all dealing with the EMR. And then what we've seen over the past few years has been this issue of delay and deny by insurance companies out the wazoo. And then when COVID hit, we lost a lot of staff, like every place. And, you know, travelers came in. And then you also had the issue with shortages of supplies. So as the surgeon, you know, we're the captain of the ship, and our patient is, you know, the important person that we're there to take care of. And it's that thing where I think we differentiate between burnout and moral injury. You know, and this was moral injury. Like, I was doing everything that I normally do, and now I was doing more than I normally do because I didn't have the supplies. I didn't have the staff. I was on the phone with insurance companies. I was, you know, that typical pajama time that we all talk about, you know, coming home late at night or on the weekends and doing my charting and in the electronic medical record. And it just really took a toll on me. And like we were talking earlier, I was supposed to give a lecture on burnout the week after I had my episode. And I had these, you know, slides of all these lists. You know, the other thing on there was a medical complication. You know, I've always prided myself and my complication rate was lower than the national average, but they're not zero events. So I had a patient that had an infection and a complication. So staying late, doing surgery, dealing with the patient, the family, the whole psychological issue of that. And that, I think a lot of patients don't realize what they're going through is one thing, but the surgeons also go through a lot when we're dealing with a patient that's got a complication.
Amen to that.
And then I got sued. So patient that had surgery at another institution came to see me for a second opinion. You know, I did the full Monty workup, got all his old records, you know, worked him up for infection, worked him up for loosening, you know, multiple x-rays, yada, yada, yada. But they blanket, you know, sue everybody when they sue people. And eventually I got dropped. But, you know, for any doctor that's been sued, you know, it's like another hit to the heart of like, you're trying so hard to do your job and do the best thing every single day. And when you get that, you just feel like you failed somewhere. And it's that issue that we all struggle with, the perfectionism that begins in college or maybe in high school. So anything that's less than perfect, you know, there's no gradients of gray. It's black or white, you know. And if we get sued, it feels like we failed. So all of that was eating me up. And then I had some tooth issues that I'm still dealing with today. So on top of all that and not sleeping and all the stress of all of those things, I was having pain, which further interrupted my sleep. But like all of us, what do? We keep going to work. Like you get the flu, you put on a mask and you go to work. Like you're sick, you just get up and go. So I kept going to work because I had full clinics. I had full ORs. And by Friday, I was like a zombie. And I don't know how I got through clinic that day, but I had started seeing a therapist prior to that because of dealing and struggling with burnout. And she'd always said, call. So from outside the clinic, I'd made it outside. And I remember calling her and basically just saying, I'm in trouble. And I didn't really grasp what was going on. You know, we compartmentalize and override. And I mean, we're taught like you can deal with a patient in this room or this OR and all hell breaks loose and something really bad happens. And you walk out and you put on that face because you walk into the next room with a smile. Hi, how you doing? So, you know, we're taught from an early age of shut those emotions down, shut your feelings down. Don't talk about them. Don't bring them up. Just keep going. And I got home. I don't know how. You know, she said, you know, if you're suicidal, go right to the ER. And I made it home and I crawled in bed. And for about 3 weeks, I didn't leave my bed. And I couldn't talk. Like my wife would kept coming in, trying to figure out what was going on. And you know, I just couldn't verbalize anything. You know, I didn't eat. I lost like 20 pounds. It was my wife that called, you know, the office manager and was just like, look, like, Adam's not going to be there on Monday, and I don't know when he's coming back. You know, and that later on ate at me, right? Because the perfectionism, I felt like I failed all of my patients that were booked for the next 3 months. And I felt like I failed my partners because now they had to deal with all of my patients. But yeah, that was a struggle. And then I was lucky enough, right? Because when we're in the healthcare field, we have money, we have health insurance. And we understand the system that many patients don't have the luxury of one or all of those things. And we have a great hospital system here in town, not the one that I work at, that has an excellent mental health program. And they have this cognitive behavioral intensive outpatient program. And, you know, I got into it and they actually wanted to admit me as an inpatient. And as bad as I was, there was like some neuron in my brain that was firing that was like, don't do that. You don't want to do that. Like, you know, what will happen to your medical license? Like, what will happen to your job? What will happen to your patients? Like, what will your family think? And if anybody, you know, listening knows the name Dr. Lorna Breen, she was a doctor in New York that during the COVID process took her own life by suicide. And as I read more about her story, like she went into this catatonic state afterwards and was fearful of getting help because she was afraid of losing her medical degree. So part of the reason I'm glad that you asked me to come here, because it's been hard for me to talk about it, but I think we need to talk about it. And I think if physicians can't deal with, talk about, admit that we have a mental health issue, why should we expect patients to come and ask for help when they're having a problem? Because like if I had a heart attack or cancer diagnosis and I was out of work, like it'd be telling everyone, hey, I just had a heart attack. I'm getting a stent put in, you know, I have cancer. I'm, you know, getting this tumor taken out. I'm going to be on chemo for 6 months. Nobody has an issue talking about that. But when we talk about mental health, everybody has a problem talking about it. So I was lucky and I was in treatment for about 4 months and then transitioned kind of, you know, to just seeing my docs on an outpatient basis. But I wasn't ready to go back to work. Like I was still not near 100%. And it took me a while and I was finally able to get back to work. It was almost a year. Like I went out in May and I was able to get back to work in March, part-time.
2023, May.
Yeah. So I went out May 2023 and, got back to work in March of, you know, 2024. And, it was a struggle. So, I mean, like one of the things, you know, I dealt with a lot was panic and panic attacks and anxiety. And just before my episode, like I had a panic attack. It was so bad. So bad that I actually wound up going to the ER and, you know, got the full Monty workup, you know, oh, you're having a heart attack coming in and yada, yada, yada. And one of the things I kind of put and described in my manuscript that I'm working on now is, you know, they were like, you're fine. It was just a panic attack. And if you've had a panic attack, again, like the doctors in the ER almost discount it. And I get it as a physician, like, hey, look, you're lucky. You didn't have a heart attack. Like you're not dying. So that's like kind of the positive. But like the negative is if I did, they would have admitted me or sent me to a cardiologist. But no one says, you know, here's the number for an outpatient therapist or psychiatrist. It's kind of, you're on your own. So I was having panic attacks and it took me a while. Like I had to like drive by the hospital like multiple times because I would have panic attacks. And then I started driving into the garage and I would just like sit in my car and finally got like the nerve up to get calmed down. Like one day where I went to my office, like on a Sunday when like no one was around. And, you know, I had we're taught in like cognitive behavioral therapy, this idea of like dipping a toe in, like you can't jump in the raging river and get wet all at once. So if you want to get across, like you got to dip a toe in and take it out. Then you kind of walk into your shins and take it out and up to your knees. And it's kind of that stepwise process. And, yeah, it took me a while to get to that point. And I was a bit nervous going back the first day, but yeah, it's funny. Like as hard as all that was, and I've always said, like, I love what I do, but I hate my job. Like, I loved operating and taking care of patients. I hate all the other crap. And when I walked into that first room, it felt so normal. It felt so natural to, like, take care of a patient. And that was, like, a breath of fresh air. Like, I came back, and I didn't forget any of that stuff. It just seemed so natural. After all the work that I put in, it was kind of nice to see that aspect of the recovery.
As a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.